You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. I've devoted a series of programs, which I hope you've listened to some of them, to the secret archives of the Vatican. There's a wonderful book by that name, The Secret Archives of the Vatican, by Maria Luisa Ambrosini. And I've quoted from various sources, but primarily from that book. In the middle of that book, she discusses some of the foreign missions and the implantation of Catholicism in distant areas, in areas far distant from its Roman center. As a matter of fact, in present-day Africa, there's a class of persons called Bintus. A Bintu is a native African who's visited one of the centers of Western civilization, London, New York, Paris, and has returned to Africa, never to be quite the same again. In the Emperor Constantine's time, the Queen of Ethiopia was a Bintu. Her parents had sent her to Alexandria as a girl to learn Greek and the manners of civilization. Now all this happened in that time, when Alexandria was a city of splendid culture. Then she had returned to the barren tablelands of Ethiopia, and she married the king and bore him sons. One day, two young boys, and they were brilliantly educated boys, and they were ardently Catholic boys, and they were survivors of an ambushed trading expedition. So these two little captives were brought to her courts. This queen, who had been to Alexandria, at last had someone to talk to. They got along famously. She made them tutors to her sons, and the land became Catholic. There had been other Catholic contacts. Catholic traders came from time to time, and according to legend, St. Matthew came. In those years of confidence, that followed the resurrection, St. Matthew had taught in Ethiopia and been martyred there. Stories from the Catholic legend, and yet something real and something very decisive must have happened. For Ethiopia to have become Catholic and to have remained Catholic, yes, it did. With Islam attacking from both sides and pagan Africa lapping at its foothills, this islanded culture kept its identity and its Catholic faith. An unsigned document in the secret archives suggests there may have been institutions making for stability. Many of these were the work of still another Bintu, King John the Holy, born 1667. And he had traveled to Jerusalem and had come back with ideas, a lot of ideas. To avoid wars of succession, he ordered this, and I quote, he ordered that the brothers of the living emperor, along with other close relatives, all of them were to be put on Mount Tamara. And on that mountain they were to be governed with all the grandeur in the world, with the exception of the firstborn son. That firstborn son was to serve the emperor. There are palaces and fountains, it goes on to say, very delicious indeed, and splendid rooms, unquote. Mount Tamara, long a center of learning, was not only a prison for princes, a place for the safekeeping of unneeded royalty, but a library, repository, and archives. I quote again, there are preserved all the holy books and all the scriptures which have been recovered from Jerusalem and from Antioch, from Constantinople, and yes, from Alexandria, and these came in various languages. Back in Rome, Cardinal Siletto, having heard of this, tried to get a list of the documents, but death put an end to such thoughts, unquote. That strongly indicates that there was a treasure there. There must have been quite an archival treasure there. Perhaps in copies, maybe some originals, who knows? A long way from Rome, Ethiopia, which is south of Egypt, as you know. Now, the country's many kings were to wear robes of aqua blue, and on their necks a chain of golden stars, and under that, a Saint Matthew, who is the protector of Ethiopia. No man could be made a noble until each of seven generations of his family had done some very notable thing on behalf of either the Catholic religion or, on the other hand, for the empire. When when Africa is slowly struggling toward literacy. It seems strange that Ethiopia had compulsory universal education. That's right, it had compulsory universal education. We're talking in the 1600s here. So King John the Holy ordered in addition that in each city a great palace, like a monastery, be built, where all the sons of the nobles, the citizens, and the common people would definitely have to go at the age of 8 years, and there learn reading and writing and all things necessary to know for the Catholic life. They stayed there from the age of 8 until they were 16. Then they joined the armies according to their rank. Well, what about the women? Well, each city was to have a woman's convent where the nuns were dressed like the knights of St. Anthony. And I quote again, in such monasteries there is a house where are put the zitelli, young girls who are 12 years of age. That's what they term the zitelli. So these girls were sent there, and there they remained by force of law, like the boys in the other monasteries, and learned the Catholic life and all the things that women should know. Now King John the Holy gave civil service status even to the prostitutes. I don't want to shock you, but he did. He gave civil service status to the prostitutes. They weren't allowed to stay inside the city, and they had to be dressed in yellow. Every one of them was dressed in yellow. These prostitutes were only for single men. A married man was not allowed to go to such a place. In case they found a married man there, according to the law, that married man was fed to the lions. Quite a penalty for adultery. Now, in addition to a guaranteed annual income, the prostitutes had time off. And the historian who writes says, there's also a chapel with images of the saints so they can hear the Mass and sermons and pray to our Lord. You know, if you spend any time around Catholic scholars or deacons or priests and theologians, you hear a lot of mention of the Council of Trent. That's the Concilium Tridentinum, and it was held between 1545 and 1563 AD in Trento, which is Trent. Actually, part of it took place in Bologna. This is in northern Italy, and it was one of the Roman Catholic Church's most important ecumenical councils. It was prompted by the Protestant Reformation. Some people consider this council to be the very embodiment of the Counter-Reformation within the Catholic Church, their reaction to the Protestant Reformation. If you listen to my programs very often, you know that I delight in renaming things. Like, for example, everybody knows about the Age of Enlightenment. I call it the Age of Darkening. More exactly describes what happened. I call the Protestant Reformation the Protestant Deformation, because I think that's more accurate and it's a lot of fun. In any case, the Council of Trent was a reaction to the rise of Protestantism, and there was a period of religious fervor that followed that council, and a new age of missions began. Now, the secret archives contain many reports, diaries, and letters written by these missionaries who went to far-flung places. Some of them, most of them, as a matter of fact, are segregated in the archives of the Propaganda Fide. But occasionally one finds summaries of long reports intended as staff papers for the use of the Pope. Now, some of these early missionary writings are hard to distinguish from travel literature. So, for this reason, they are used as source material, valuable source material, for subjects like economic history. For example, the developing nations think they had a golden age of plenty before the white man came. Well, some of these local legends are true, and some of them aren't true. So these early accounts written by the missionaries, who really had no preconceived notions, are very valuable photographs, sort of what was going on in these missionary countries at the time. Let me quote from an example of what a missionary wrote. Quote, "The land is bitter and sterile of nourishment. The wheat is scarce, and so is the wine." Well, that doesn't sound very good, does it? But at other times, they give a picture of prosperity. For example, a traveler to Persia, 1572, says, quote, "There's a great abundance of grain and of meat. The old as well as the young eat four times a day and very well," which may tell us something about the conditions of the old in Renaissance Italy. This writer goes on to speak of the city of Taurus. Wait till you hear this, which took one whole day to walk across, with its endless gardens full of fruit beyond description, for goodness and beauty. A city divided into 45 areas, each with its own bazaar. And in the Philippines, a 17th century Jesuit missionary writes, and I'm quoting, "The whole country has a great abundance of many foodstuffs. Rice is raised not only in the valleys, but in the mountains, as grain or hay are raised in Spain. Beans and lentils grow as very high herbs and trees. The country's full of palm trees, and coconut gathering goes on all year long for the liquid that the coconuts contain. A great quantity of silk comes in from China, and everyone wears silk, even the sailors." Later in the century, Jesuit missionaries were sent to Russia on a diplomatic mission to ask the help of Ivan the Terrible against the Turks. The Pope chose as apostolic nuncio Antonio Posavino, a Jesuit of the same age as the Tsar, an interesting and perhaps a very valid principle for choosing diplomats. There's a letter, 1581, from Father Posavino to the Cardinal of Cuomo. Now, this letter gives an account of Father Posavino's entrance into Muscovy. You know what greeted him? 400 horsemen, all dressed in brocade, and they came to meet him in the name of their prince. Now, the Tsar sent Posavino a gift. It was a Chinese horse, but countergifts to the Tsar were a problem for Posavino. Had learned by now that the picture of a Madonna with four doctors of the church, which he had brought, was quite unsuitable. You know why? Here's what Posavino wrote. "They would not have accepted it under any circumstances. Our Lord, though still a child, is painted nude, and St. John the Baptist is mainly nude. So an Agnus Dei was hurriedly substituted." Well, what do you say? Shall we take a little break? Okay, I'll be right back. Chuck Coughlin here.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
You're listening to redboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. So, taking up the thread where we had broken it with this interruption, what they call a break, I'm kidding, of course, we had just observed that Father Antonio Posavino, a Jesuit, had gone in 1581 to Moscow and met with Ivan the Terrible, the Tsar. The Catholic Church was actually seeking the aid of Ivan the Terrible. And diplomatic relations were certainly difficult. Audiences with the Tsar were very short, and each time Ivan the Terrible was mentioned at all, his titles had to be recited after his name. And there was a long string of very grandiose titles. The Terrible was only the first of them, and sounds rather funny to us today, doesn't it? Posavino was enraged to see that after each meeting with him, the Tsar washed his hands in a golden basin, as if to cleanse himself of the filth from this Italian. Nevertheless, Posavino went on a second mission to Moscow, and from these two expeditions, he drew material for his manuscript, Muscovy, published by the Jesuits, 1592. Muscovy, that's Moscow. So missionaries of the early period, like those of earlier ages, tended to follow what the economists call the trickle-down theory. If the ruler and his family could be converted, then the whole country might become Catholic. There was no objection to forced conversion. In the 1530s, Paul III could write to the Congolese King Alfonso, "My dear, with the very greatest joy has come to our knowledge that your majesty encourages with continuous exhortation and catechizing these people, not only yours, but those nearby, to the Catholic faith, and to the propagation of our holy religion without respite, with exhortation and admonition to the other unbelieving kings, and also with constriction if necessary." That's unquote. From time to time, during the Middle Ages, priests and friars had made their way into the Asian landmass and had written of the grasslands where 30-foot-wide mobile homes were drawn by teams of 22 oxen driven 11 abreast. Travelers had described Chinese cities, their extent, their luxury, their marble bridges. Asia was entering into the mind of Europe. Even Milton in Paradise Lost wrote of it. And knowledge of the West also was penetrating back into Asia. By the 17th century, China was ready to appreciate Western science. Through it, Jesuits hoped to teach Western philosophy and perhaps Catholicism. The emperors were delighted with clocks and sundials. Though teaching them time, one might also teach them eternity. For the Jesuit Matteo Ricci, and I've done a program on him, and his followers in particular, they saw an opportunity that existed in the condition of the Chinese calendar. China had a scientific calendar at one time, but it had become increasingly erroneous, and someone had lost the instructions. Revisions had to be on an empirical basis. Had to be based on reality, right? Well, Matteo Ricci received a formal request to revise it. Knowing that this was beyond him, he wrote to superiors in Rome, asking them to send a real astronomer. Years went by, no real astronomer arrived from Rome. When the news of Galileo's discovery of the telescope reached Peking, the Jesuits wrote to Galileo for help. He didn't answer. Kepler, however, answered all the questions that the missionaries had put to him and sent them copies of his works. When the Chinese government asked the three local schools of astronomy, Chinese, Mohammedan, and European, to predict the exact time of an expected eclipse, who got it correctly? The Chinese? Nope. The Mohammedans? Nope. The European Catholics? They got it. They predicted the exact time of the eclipse. So by 1634, China adopted the new Western calendar. Matter of fact, Pope Gregory's calendars were used by every nation in the world. One of our great contributions, but one of thousands of great contributions of the glorious Catholic Church, of the works of the Catholic Church, the works that do save us. Western art was less appreciated. The Chinese wanted to know whether the original of the portraits really had one side of the face darker than the other. They didn't do that. Everything was uniformly lit in Chinese painting. They didn't get these shadows. What Italians call chiaroscuro, light and dark. The cultural exchange went in both directions. Jesuits began to see more and more in Confucius, more and more to admire. The Chinese, they said, were not worshiping their ancestors, but reverencing them. Not worshiping, reverencing. Something directed in the Ten Commandments, honor thy father and mother. In fact, they found that they could make a very attractive catechism out of quotations from the Chinese philosophers. What's that you say? Natural law? Yeah, that's right, natural law. What about in India? Well, there was a Jesuit there too, Roberto di Nobili. He was working among the Indian upper classes by following Indian customs. It was better to start in the upper castes there. He wore a long robe of yellow, three of them, as a matter of fact, in gold, representing the Holy Trinity, and two in silver, the body and soul of the adorable human, the Adorabile Humanita. In other words, the two robes represented the two natures of Christ, the human and the divine. The body and soul. He presented himself as a Roman Raja who had renounced the world. Visitors were told they could not see him because he was meditating on divine law. Those who he converted to Catholicism were allowed to continue to follow native customs, to retain their caste, to celebrate the winter equinox with its sun god implications, to wear forehead marks of the ashes of sandalwood, which Di Nobili himself blessed for them. This assortment of adaptations came to be known as the Malabar Rites. The Malabar Rites. And the Jesuits' rivals, the Dominicans and Franciscans, watching the success of their method and believing them to be an adulteration of Catholicism, did make a protest, a formal protest in Rome. Letters took years to come and go, and it was a very long time before the matter was resolved, and maybe it's never been resolved. At times, the Pope tried to speed the matters along by sending conditional directives. If the rites were such and such, they were permissible on the other hands. If they were so and so, as described, they were illicit rites. In the end, however, the Malabar rites were forbidden. Yes, they were forbidden. When the controversy over the Malabar rites broke out, the Jesuits were teaching Euclid, liberally laced with theology, to the Chinese emperor. But the dissension within the church and the papal rejection of so much the Chinese valued irritated him and wounded him deeply. Centuries later, in 1940, the secretary of the Propaganda Fide, Monsignor Celso Constantini, commented as follows. The emperor was on the verge of conversion. If he had been converted, all of China certainly would have followed the example of this son of heaven. The sad conflict about the Malabar rites was probably the main cause of alienating the emperor from the Catholic religion. Think about that. In our new evangelization, isn't that something to think about? Maybe, just maybe, some of the conflict that is among us over seemingly important but not really too important matters of theology or Catholic practice, some of those conflicts maybe should be kept behind closed doors or not to indulge in too freely on Facebook and Twittering, because it drives people away. I'm talking about, say, the casual observer. It probably just turns them off. There really has to be a certain conformity to a certain standard, the Catholic standard, the one that Christ left us and has passed to us through the apostles. It's good to have discussion. One really needs to be humble about one's own opinion and realize it's just one's opinion. To someone that just overhears it, a passerby, it's so easy for collateral damage to occur without our knowing it. Somebody standing near enough to the argument to be damaged by it because they really don't understand it or the reason for the disagreements. When you think about the controversy over the Malabar rites, something really to be concerned about. However, today there would be a nation of over 1 billion people who would be primarily Catholic. And what horrors that occurred in these intervening centuries might have been avoided had they been Catholic. Today, people of the Catholic Church are accustomed to making every possible concession to native opinion. And we probably find it strange that the Catholic Church was willing to lose China and India for points of custom. We think of the tom-toms in the Vatican, of the church literature in Pidgin English. I'll quote that. Jesus, him the foreman, belong you me. And yet, what would have been the practical consequences of early Christianization of China and India? Well, for one, greater cultural interchange, better acquaintance with Oriental life and thought, more rapid westernization and industrialization of the Orient. Would this be progress toward the old dream of Alexander, or progress toward earlier wars? Well, if you ask me, I think the result would have been excellent, excellent. And I have some examples to offer, a lot of examples to offer. There's a great example in Paraguay that occurred of what could happen with this cross-fertilization of cultures. It's the Reducciones, which I've done a complete program on. You can find that on the podcast. That were the subject for the movie The Mission with Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons. The success of the Reducciones can be viewed as a miracle. It was amazing. After the break, I'm going to briefly talk about them. And I think that podcast is not available anymore. But I'm going to redo it. I'm going to do a complete program on the Reducciones. It's a story that needs to be brought out. On breadboxmedia.com, this is Chuck Coughlin.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. Just before the break, we're talking about the reductions, the reducciones, these communal colonies under Jesuit missionaries in South America, in the area that is now Paraguay, Uruguay, and part of Argentina, quite a large area. And the Spanish government was attempting to get the hunter-gatherer, very primitive lifestyle of the Guarani Indians and modify it into more communal, city-oriented lifestyle, knowing that they would, if they followed the European model, that they would become more prosperous. People would live longer. There would be more care for the aged. And, of course, part of it was converting them to be Catholics and to care for each other in a new and special way and love their enemy and join together in a communal effort. Well, it was soon discovered that the colonies that the Spanish government ran, government-run colonies, that they didn't work. They weren't successful. The Indians wandered off into the jungle. And these reductions meant the gathering of these people together, the reducing them into a small geographic area where you would garden and farm. But it did work where the Jesuits, in certain cases, had a lot of authority because the Guarani Indians would obey the Jesuits. But let's go deeper. Genetically, these Guarani Indians had a very great artistic intelligence and an industriousness that went with it. So the methods that the Jesuits followed wouldn't transfer easily elsewhere because a lot of the credit goes to the intelligent industriousness of the Guarani Indians. And this is despite the fact that they were semi-naked savages living a hunter-gatherer lifestyle in the South American jungle. They could jump quickly into a more advanced lifestyle if given the European Catholic influence of the Jesuits. So the Spanish crown, observing this, decided to let the Jesuits take over, and they actually ceded ownership of this huge area, bigger than a South America country. They ceded ownership of that to the Jesuits. So the Jesuits became owner dictators, but they were very benign dictators, weren't they? Very benign. They allowed the election of a prime minister, and they installed a paradise. It was a Catholic paradise. There was a 4-day work week, a 6-hour work day, care for the aged, cradle of the grave care. Everyone was well fed and cared for. There was 100% literacy because the schools were excellent. Who had the first printing press in the New World? The Guarani Indians. Yes, they did. There was a great culture among these Guarani Indians in these colonies called the reductions. Reductions in the sense that they meant gathering the people together who had been dispersed in this hunter-gatherer lifestyle throughout the jungle in South America. They brought them into a communal areas with certain other people, perhaps genetically it wouldn't have worked. It worked with the Guarani, who are rather amazing people. So they had this 100% literate lifestyle, first printing press in the New World, and they started making watches that they exported to Europe. They started making violins that they exported to Europe, as are small examples, many other things. And they became rather well-to-do. That led to their downfall when the Portuguese slavers from São Paulo, Brazil, they called them Paulistas, invaded in war after war and took them as slaves. They wanted these capable people as slaves. And they thought they had found gold. They must be mining gold because they were so prosperous. What they were mining was Catholicism in a way of life. So the Jesuits had tried what was a communal life with such a success that their settlements, their reductions, entered into European thought. All this was a success for a long period, about 1610 to 1750. That's 140 years, in which the Jesuits maintained a paradise in Paraguay. And when it fell not because of inner weakness, but to outside invasion from the Paulistas. Their achievement is more notable in that the Guarani Indians involved were not among the most advanced American peoples. They were cannibal in war, weavers, and cultivators of rubber, without the social infrastructure of the Incan Empire, with whom they sometimes traded. They had no real concept of the boundaries of a region or a nation state. They didn't think that way. And when the missionaries tried to explain hell to them, they said tranquilly, "That's fine, but it won't be cold there." The Jesuits probably got much of the inspiration for their communal lifestyle from European monasteries. Religious groups have always been a refuge from the competitive economy, the capitalist economy. Other possible sources were Thomas More's Utopia, and somehow from Augustine's City of God and Plato's Republic, various utopian visions. Now, each of these reductions or communes had at least 2,000 people, and many of them had beautiful architecture. The United Nations has included 20 of these abandoned now reducciones among their World Heritage Sites. And you can go there into the jungle and see this magnificent Spanish cities, sometimes of up to 20,000 people were inhabiting them in the old days. These great Spanish colonial doors going into the big cathedrals. A lot of it's in ruins, but it's magnificent. And it was built by the Indians under the direction and architectural genius of these great Jesuit missionaries and are preserved in our tourist location. But very few people know about them. But they have magnificent cathedrals in the Spanish colonial style. So each of the communes had at least 2,000 people and often 5 or 10,000. And when they became too crowded, they split off and a new town was built on a principle later used in the new towns of Britain. The plans of the towns were uniform. There was a great central square with palms and orange trees. Around it were the most important public buildings, the church, of course, or cathedral, the rectory where the priest lived, the workshops, the guest houses, the community hall with its arches and columns. And there's an interesting symmetry going on here. In each of these far-flung communes, some great distances from each other, there were the same number of columns and the same number of arches used in the architecture. The streets were straight and laid out in a matrix so one could walk straight across the city. And the sidewalks were all covered to protect one from the sun. Orchards were rich with oranges, lemons, peaches, almonds. Travelers of the time greatly admired these planned cities and compared them with Buenos Aires and La Plata, compared them favorably with those places. The Guarani were transformed into livestock raisers, masons, carpenters. They worked not more than 6 hours a day, and they worked while they sang and there was music. The community provided everything needed. Their industrial progress was incredible. By the end of the experiment, they were running printing presses and making watches and musical instruments. All the children were educated. Adults said their multiplication tables to the Lord after Mass. Not kidding. That's never really happened. The adults said their multiplication tables to the Lord after Mass. They progressed more rapidly than the Jesuits realized. Toward the end of the experiment, some of them demanded the right to enter the priesthood. But when the reducciones were turned over to Portugal in a royal barter deal, the people of the reducciones fought bitterly for 5 years to protect their communities. These communities were ended forever by a conclave. So the Guarani settlements had existed and succeeded, and they must take their place with the state-owned galleries of Venice as one of history's great contrary facts. The methods the Jesuits used in these little republics are available to all kinds of countries. Could they be modified and adapted to the democratic system? If so, we might realize great benefits. So missionaries and travelers left Rome for far countries, but travelers from the far countries were also coming to Rome. In the room of Sixtus V in the Vatican Library, there's a fresco showing Sixtus taking possession of the Lateran in 1585. That's a palace, the Lateran. In the procession are four young Japanese in European clothing, long robes of black velvet. These were the Japanese Christian princes who had come on a pilgrimage to Rome. The secret archives of the Vatican has a few documents that gives us little quick snapshots of the visits of these princes from Japan. First of all, that the journey took 2.5 years to get there from Japan. And then there's this vision. King Philip II of Spain asked one of them to take off a shoe so he could see how it was made. Another thing that is recorded is their gifts to the Pope. One was the horn of a unicorn. One was an ebony writing tablet. There were two goblets of rhinoceros bone to drink from. This rhinoceros bone was said to be immune from containing poisoning substances. Finally, in 1585, the Japanese princes left Rome to return to Japan by way of Venice and Genoa. In Venice, here's a quote, a very solemn procession was made for their edification, which, in addition to the many holy relics and great quantities of silver, gold, and jewels, arranged in different ways. Several tableaus were staged with living actors of sacred history, of the Old and New Testaments, and of the martyrdom of saints. All of these were depicted. The last may have been an omen, for a dozen years later, Japan crucified thousands of its Catholics. Let us pray for the souls of those who were so martyred, and let us pray for the souls of those who so persecuted them that they crucified thousands of Catholics. Let's take a break now. This is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight about Catholic history. Breadboxmedia.com is a webcasting miracle, a Catholic global network. I'm proud to be a part of it because we do historical apologetics here for the benefit of the Catholic Church, to correct the misinformation, and hopefully to provide some small stepping stone for bringing people into the faith or bringing them back into the faith. This is Chuck Coughlin. Back in a moment.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. An unsigned report in 1659 in the secret archives relates some customs and habits of the Muscovite ambassadors who at present are in Leghorn on their way to the embassy in Venice. The report writer's attitude is that of a biologist observing a new species, rather objective and removed and remote. I'll read from it. Quote, there are two ambassadors. The first is a prince, and the second his secretary of state. But they treat each other as equals. They have with them four noblemen and their papasso, or priest, who is always on his neck a tabernacle with a small lighted candle, in which is the Madonna or St. Nicholas, their protector. They pray to St. Nicholas for everything they need, and if they do not obtain the mercy they ask for, then they beat the saint furiously. However, the writer thought the ambassadors to be, well, very handsome. The visitors wore sable-lined garments, with the front of them embroidered with pearls. Quote, they think it is as cold here as our own country to wear that. Or perhaps they had no lighter garments. The writer continues with disapproving comments on the Russians' intrapersonal relations. They beat their servants personally and so brutally that four or five of them have almost died. When they found their priest drunk, they punished him severely and tied him up one day and one night to the bedpost. These Russians have very little money or letters of exchange, but they do have a fortune in sable furs and, in addition, a great quantity of caviar and some other salted fish that actually smells terrible. They're very stingy in spending money, as they're not accustomed to using it. Although in Leghorn they have been lodged in a very large house or palace, they use only two rooms where all of them stay, and they sleep on the floor. There were 32 in the party, and it was impossible to get the prince to sleep in the bed. He was afraid of falling out. Their drinking habits were puzzling to the writer. The government of Leghorn, on behalf of the Grand Duke, gave them great quantities of excellent wine, which they rated very highly. But then they put all the wines they had into a barrel, white and dark together, without distinction as the kind of wine. When the governor took them around in his carriage, they got out not by opening the doors or waiting for them to be opened, but by jumping over them, a natural gesture for horsemen. Their table manners failed to meet Italian standards. though they were obviously trying to learn. At a formal dinner, the Muscovites, having noticed the governor eating soup with a spoon, took the soup with their hands and put it into the spoon, and took the meat in their hands and impaled it on the fork. The ambassador, having put a piece of meat in his mouth without the fork, spat it out, put it on a fork, and ate it again. The ambassador had a weakness for beautiful women and made them generous gifts of sables and caviar. One day, having seen an extremely beautiful woman in a carriage, he kept asking who she was, and learning that she was the wife of a doctor. At home that night, the ambassador began to shout that he had a terrific pain in his stomach and asked that he be taken to the home of the doctor, who was her husband. Their next stop was Florence, and they were taking with them a ridiculous sort of luggage, empty boxes, empty wine jars, and even empty bottles, saying that it was a sign of grandeur to travel with much luggage. They had 15 boatloads of it to take to Florence. The report writer's advice to Florence was to give them plenty of parties. True or exaggerated, these anecdotes are remarkably like the story that one hears at the United Nations about the representatives of the new republics. The Catholic Church and the world intersect in modern Rome. For the missionary efforts of the 19th and 20th centuries established the Catholic faith in many African and Oriental communities. We no longer object to the ways of the native cultures. In fact, we seem prepared to accept almost any native practice, maybe short of female circumcision. The emphasis on indigenous priesthoods and even on indigenous hierarchies has brought young men from all over the world to the seminaries and religious establishments of Rome. Handsome, eager young men carrying their cheap plastic briefcases. They visit the shrines of Catholic history to gaze at St. Peter's table, St. Gregory's chair, or St. Benedict's boarding house. And they try to figure out the form within these little maps they give out. But they have a modern place of pilgrimage, too, the Standa, Rome's equivalent of Walmart. One sees them there, intent, utterly accepting, looking at the coiled green serpents of plastic garden hose, at the hen-shaped clay chicken cookers, at the colored glass that all of us could recognize as beautiful if it were in a properly authenticated mosaic instead of in cheap jewelry. Their love for these wonders is so apparent that even the little bad-tempered clerks of the Standa are almost nice to them, almost. In a year or two, they will return to Asia, to Africa, sometimes to a lifetime of hard work, sometimes to martyrdom, now and then to politics. These people are the newest of the Catholic Church's long line of Bentus, the people who have been to and return home. They are the Bentus. This time of missionaries was a fascinating time. 250 years pass, and let's turn our time travel boots toward Rome. Let's go back home to Rome. What was going on there in Rome, the center of everything, 250 years later? Well, the Italian sun was shining as always, and Napoleon Bonaparte, a man who would be emperor, he arrived and found in Italy, which had lived for 2.5 centuries, under the decrees of the Council of Trent. This was an Italy in which people thought before they spoke, in which scientists chose safe channels, such as biology, for their work. Isolated as we were from Northern Europe, we still had many visitors, young Englishmen on the grand tour, viewing classical remains and carrying home with them chunks of marble and the memory of chambermaids, writers, and thinkers like Anderson and Goethe, in search of the land of the Citroën, the land of the oranges. And then there were archaeologists excited about the ruins of Pompeii. The Reformation was so long ago that some of them could even regard the church aesthetically and admire its stylized beauty instead of arguing its theology. The papal court was less a part of Roman social life than it had been, though the cardinals and the ambassadors still entertained generously. Rome had two aristocracies, The old medieval aristocracy, founded mainly on the nation's military past, the legendary families of the Conti, the Cenci, the Frangipani, the Orsini, the Colonna, and the new aristocracy, made up of the great papal families, the Borghesi, the Barberini, the Chigi, the Odescalchi, the Albani. The rich gifts of the popes had made them enormously wealthy. Italy was a country of the very rich and the very poor, and the crime rate was extremely high. If you read the descriptions, you start to realize that Rome must have been more beautiful then than now, although it is beautiful now. Actually, the splendid Baroque buildings were new, and greenness was not yet being crowded out of the city. Attempts were even being made to keep it clean. Rome was still a country town. The Forum was a cattle field. Grazed by herds of oxen, there were stables next the way of the cross of the Colosseum, and barnyard mud around the Arch of Constantine. The Mont Gaufrier fire balloons that the Romans loved had to be banned from the city because their pans of burning coal set fire to haystacks when they came down. The streets at night were dark except for the flicker of the small oil lamps before the images of the Madonna. The shops were little, like those of Pompeii. Goods and services were advertised by pictorial signs, large red or black hands for a glover, a brass bowl for a barber. Cafes had begun to appear. The first was the Café Veneziano. Cafes, which are a wonderful feature of Rome today. Cafes had begun to appear. The first was the Café Veneziano, with its cloth windows and its Etruscan lamps burning in the dark interior. A meeting place for ladies and their abbots. A little later, there was a Café del Greco on the Via Condotti. That is now the most elegantly bohemian snack bar in Rome, its marble tables and leather benches graced forever by the English and German poets who frequented it in the old days. And the secret archives, too, were moving gradually into the modern age. The cardinal archivist Garampi was compiling his tortuous, mysterious card catalog with its cards glued together into 124 folio volumes and its puzzling signs and abbreviations all through it. When he died in 1792, leaving his library of 16,000 volumes in the Vatican Library and Archives, he was succeeded by another great archivist, Angelo Mai, who introduced the systematic use of one of the most interesting of archivistic games. As a young seminary student, Mai had hunted out parchments that showed evidence of erasure and rewriting. The reusers had, of course, written not on the erased lines, but on the undamaged parchment between them. Over the erased lines, he passed a small brush dipped in the Noce di Gallo coloring, and the old writing came to life. He had discovered the palimpsest, the written over parchment, and the palimpsest will be the subject of our next program on the secret archives of the Vatican. On breadboxmedia.com, this is Chuck Coughlin. Very excited to go on to that next section. Thank you for listening.